It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our nation's economy grew strongly in the second half of last year, while Wisconsin hit its lowest unemployment rate last April since the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics started tracking those numbers in 1976. But is a recession looming? Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Menzi Chin is a public affairs and economics professor at UW-Madison. Menzi, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
You know, after like years of forecasting a recession, economists seem increasingly kind of muddled, perplexed about the strength of the American economy and whether there is a recession looming. What is your view on the likelihood?
Well, I think we have to make a distinction between the fact that there's a difference between a recession not apparently hitting yet and possibly a recession sometime in the future. And so going back to recent history, we know that in past recessions, there's been this period where people have said, we dodged the bullet and a recession isn't coming along. And yet, eventually, the numbers come in so as to indicate that, in point of fact, the economy had slowed down and gone into a recession. So I think we need to be a little bit humble about the timing, the accuracy and timing with respect to recessions. Right now, the data is looking quite strong and stronger than many, many people would have expected a year ago, including myself. But you can see that, you know, either a combination of other events, geopolitical or otherwise, or something that's surprising and unforecastable shows up and you do go into a slowdown. That being said, I think you're right. Most economists thought a year ago that we would be in a recession by now. And it's just been the case that the American consumer in particular has been particularly resilient in terms of sustaining the economy.
So what indicators stand out to you as you look into the future and a potential downturn?
Well, the single best predictor of whether there's a recession is actually sounds quite abstruse, but it's the spread or a gap between the 10-year yield on treasuries and the 3-month yield. And so that's called the spread on tens and threes. And it's the reason why it works, the first thing is to say that over the past 50, 60 years, there's not really a case where you can point to where it's failed to indicate the onset of a recession or falsely signaled a recession coming within, let's say, 6 to 18 months. Okay. That's why it's the single best indicator. Why it works is the usual reasoning is because the 10-year yield is like the average of the short-term rates, and you're subtracting off the short-term rate, and that short-term rate is typically heavily influenced by what the Fed does. And so if that spread goes negative, that's like saying the Fed's raised the interest rate in the short term high. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the markets are expecting the average of short-term rates to be low, which happens often when you're going into a recession. And so there's a kind of an economic reasoning for why the single indicator works. It's because it's signaling this combination of policy that the Fed's undertaking to try to cool off the economy and in response to recessions. And so far, that's worked pretty well.
And the central bank has been, you know, at work trying to tame inflation. And, you know, we saw the report yesterday that it may take longer before the Federal Reserve is ready to start cutting interest rates. What did you make out of the new inflation numbers?
Well, I think there are two parts. Well, there are actually two things that have come out recently. First part is exactly inflation's a little bit more persistent than we would have expected. And so it's going to take a little bit longer than the market previously anticipated, okay? And longer in terms of beating down inflation means that people's calculations of how long the Fed will keep interest rates high, that path or trajectory has been pushed up a little bit. And so in some sense, that probably increases the likelihood that the Fed miscalculates and pushes the economy, if not into a recession, into a slowdown. I'd say that one thing to keep in mind is what matters is not so much what actually happens now, as much as people's expectations about what inflation will be. The Fed also looks at that. And what's true is that expectations about what inflation will be a year from now have pretty much come down to 3%.
Okay.
Around there. And you might say 3% is still different from the 2%.
Right.
But this is 3% for CPI inflation. And just to get a little bit technical, the Fed targets PCE inflation, personal consumption expenditure inflation. And that is usually maybe half a point lower. So in point of fact, we're not super far away in some senses from the Fed's target.
Talking about the economy with UW-Madison Professor Menzi Chin, our guide teaches public affairs and economics. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Menzi, New York Times columnist and Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman argued against describing our economy as a Goldilocks economy. He was alluding to the fairy tale in which Goldilocks finds a bowl of porridge as not too hot, not too cold. How well does that description line up with the actual economy?
I mean, I think that the economy, if you look at it from the perspective of what we would have thought we would have had, let's say, a year and a half ago, it's remarkable how well it's done. You know, most economists would have said we were going to have some sort of big downward blip at the end of 2023 into the beginning of 2024. And yet, here we are growing at 3.1% in the fourth quarter. You know, annualized. And, you know, if you think of the sort of trend growth rate that we expect for the U.S. economy, about 2%, well, we're doing quite well. It's surprising how much along, you know, so many indicators, including inflation, we're outperforming what we, any sort of the sort of median projection you would have seen a year ago. I mean, there are definitely dark spots. Those include, for instance, if I was looking at industrial production, you might say, well, it's been flat for half a year. If I were looking at the possibilities of crises in, let's say, medium-sized banks or in commercial real estate, I think that's the big domestic concern that I have, then you would say, well, it's just, you know, the things that are about to happen that could derail the U.S. economy. That being said, you know, if I were just looking on the indicators that I have now, which admittedly are backwards looking, you know, we just got the numbers for January inflation, and here we are in, you know, halfway through February. I mean, looking backwards, at least right now, things look particularly good.
Particularly good. But, you know, one of those sticking points is housing costs. And certainly the Fed is watching those prices as well. How might that affect our economy?
Well, there are two sides to the housing cost issue, at least two sides. I mean, if we're talking about the fact of the housing sector reflecting the strength of the economy, well, in some sense, housing rebounding indicates that the, you know, both households have the funds to keep on buying houses, supporting the price of houses, despite the fact that interest rates have gone up so much. So that's a plus on the side of indicating sustained growth. On the other hand, we have to take into account the Fed's reaction to those housing prices. And that's twofold, because housing is a portion of investment to the extent that you're building new houses. If you're building new houses, that's exactly what the Fed in some sense wants not to do. And not specifically houses, but it wants to cool off the economy. And so it's going in the wrong direction. That would tend to make the Fed want to tighten or keep monetary policy tight. In this sense, keeping interest rates, the Fed funds rate, high. The other thing is that housing prices feed into what's called the owner equivalent rent. That is in the CPI. One component of the CPI is exactly
consumer price index.
You know, what's the implied cost of living. In terms of shelter. And so that's going to put upward pressure on the consumer price index and inflation, exactly. And once again, to the extent that the Fed doesn't like seeing inflation way above its target, then it's going to keep the interest rate higher for longer. And that, once again, heightens the possibility that you might tumble into a recession or at least a slowdown.
We're looking at the health of the economy with UW-Madison Professor of Public Affairs and Economics, Menzi Chin. Join the conversation. Call in with your question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About a quarter of business economists and analysts predict a recession this year. That's in a new survey by the National Association of Business Economists. So why the pessimism, despite a really strong labor market and Wall Street highs? Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UW-Madison Public Affairs and Economics Professor Menzi Chin is our guide. Let's bring in John in Boaz. John, what is your question?
Good morning. I would like to talk with the professor to see what he thinks about what I have to say. One is, my father lived through the Depression in New York City tenements. Number two, right now, as far as I can see, we are in a big debt with our federal deficit, and it's like filling up a balloon. Number three, we are living with money in the bank. It's a blip on the computer disk at your bank. Please ask the professor to explain how the gold standard works.
John, thanks. So using gold as a way to set the value of money. Go ahead, Menzi.
Okay, well, let me turn to the second issue about the national debt. And so if we think about it, the federal government has been borrowing year after year, essentially for decades. The last time we ran a budget surplus was during the Clinton years, so you immediately know it's been a long time. And so right now we're approaching something like the debt held by the public, of federal debt. By public, I mean both the Fed and individuals and foreigners. It's about close to 100% of GDP. That is, in order to pay it all off in 1 year, you'd have to give up 1 year's worth of GDP. Now, of course, we would never do that, pay off all the debt in 1 year, but that gives you an idea about exactly how much debt we have out there. So when you hear some number that's trillions and trillions, well, GDP is also trillions and trillions. Mm-hmm. So first of all, we owe it to ourselves. That's most of what we owe. We owe some of it to foreigners. One thing I'll say is this is a long-term problem. We've been seeing the debt accumulate, and the big bumps were when? Big bumps were after the 2007-2008 financial crisis, and then another big bump, the biggest bump in dollar terms, certainly almost, I say, it's the biggest bump in percentage of GDP terms, was post-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've accumulated this debt, but even had we not undergone these sort of big events, debt would be increasing over time. And over time, the reason why it's happening is because spending outstrips revenues. And what's going to be driving more and more of that spending is entitlements. So while it might be tempting to say, oh, we've got to fix this problem now by cutting spending now, you could take out all discretionary spending, take to zero defense spending, take to zero everything else that the federal government does, take that spending to zero, and you would still have a problem with debt growing over time because of Social Security and Medicare, entitlements plus interest payments that we are accruing. So we have a longer-term problem over time which certainly has to be dealt with, but you have to be realistic in terms of how you deal with it. It's got to be a combination of changes to the entitlements plus revenues, which includes taxes. Okay, mm-hmm. That's a longer-term problem. And so in some sense, it's not the short-term issue, but it's certainly a longer-term problem. The second thing about the gold standard is it's just plain unrealistic, I think, to think about going back to the gold standard. Gold standard meant that every dollar that was issued, this is approximate, had to be backed up by some amount of physical commodity like gold. Well, what did that do? That essentially meant that you restricted the pace of growth of money, but it didn't do anything about the stability of the banking system. And so during the period in which the America was on the gold standard and the world was on the gold standard, it would be wrong to think that was a period that was marked by the absence of banking crises and hence recessions. Hmm. So maybe the pace at which prices rose was slower during the gold standard. In fact, I'm almost positive that's going to be the case. On the other hand, what was the cost? The cost was much more financial instability. And it's not clear to me you could maintain the gold standard domestically, even within a given country now, given you would need to have the political support for something which kept prices essentially constant.
We're talking about the economy and how it works. UW-Madison Professor Menzi Chin with us teaches public affairs and economics. Call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Menzi, you mentioned the post-COVID bump of America's debt. I wonder, do you see, has our economy fully recovered from the pandemic?
Well, once again, I have to say it's been remarkable what's been accomplished in the several years after the peak of the COVID pandemic occurred. You know, if you look at trends in, you know, employment, if you look at trends in real wages, you know, those things have been largely restored. Mm-hmm. And I think much to the surprise of most people. Now, on the other hand, we did use a lot of fiscal stimulus in order to achieve that, you know, transfers to people, measures to prevent firms from collapsing, which was a very, very big part of the total spending that we undertook. If you look, remember the Paycheck Protection mm-hmm, Program, which mm-hmm. essentially gave transfers to businesses, not people, but businesses to keep people on the books during the shutdowns and in the aftermath. Well, you know, you might say, okay, that was money that we've gone into debt. We've gone into debt as a consequence. And on the other hand, you prevented the scarring that might have occurred where you had these firms disappear, banks go under, people, you know, be pushed out of their homes and onto the streets. So in some ways, you could say maybe that's an investment.
Okay, yeah.
You know, how can I prove that? In the rest of the world, in Europe, you know, they've had much less stellar performance. And so you might say, well, maybe that was exactly the right thing to do.
Well, as you look at industries and companies, we're seeing the stock market breaking records. The S&P 500 recently crossed the 5,000 mark. Why is mm-hmm. Wall Street doing well despite these recession concerns?
Well, I think, first of all, the recession concerns have as you mentioned, diminished substantially. You know, you talk about 29% is a high percentage, but it's much more marked down from where it was a year ago. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's a renewed confidence both in that aspect, the sort of the conditions facing the business sector. Mm-hmm. On top of that, though, up until yesterday, I think there was a lot of confidence, perhaps overconfidence, that the Fed had reached the peak in terms of its interest rates and would be dropping interest rates. And, you know, lower interest rates are key to the stock market, holding everything else constant. You know, the lower the interest rate in general, the higher the valuation you're going to have of stocks. And so you can see the logic there. When people revise their expectations about interest rates upwards, then the stock market took a dive. The other things to take into account include the sort of distribution of these gains. A large portion of the gains are the Magnificent Seven in the stock market. So that is the these major tech firms and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's highly concentrated, and it could be specific to those firms in part. So yes, the general economy seems to be doing well, but some particular firms seem to be doing particularly well. Well, and so I'm a little loath to extrapolate completely from the stock market to the general economy.
Well, Menzi, thank you so much for the explainer. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Menzi, thanks for having me.
Menzi Chin, public affairs and economics professor at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.